And the lessons are that modified gravity gets some things really right that dark matter has trouble with. Dark matter in the traditional way I'm going to tell you about next. And but it also, the way it was first formulated clearly is not the way to formulate it. And so that kind of points to why it's more useful to phrase things in terms of effective descriptions. And so all I'm going to really do is get to the point of saying it'd be nice to have an effective description, say that there's an effective description, and then we'll move on. Because the main points are really qualitative here. But anyway, so the upshot member of the and I have in mind here as the example I'm going to use is MOND. Modified Newtonian dynamics is what MOND stands for. And so the way it's set up is, you know, you would have had MA is equal to minus G, or I guess we want the absolute values of it to be G M over R squared. And so the proposal is, well, there's really a function here. I wrote it as the whole function was different, but traditionally they write it as being, there's a factor there. And the idea is that this factor mu of x, when a is large, goes to 1. And mu of x goes to x when x is much less than 1. And then in that limit where mu is x, then this side is a squared. And you remember the nice thing about having a squared there was that, so for a much less than a naught, then the observation was that you had a squared is the thing that's proportional to, or a is proportional to the square root of gm over r squared. And that's, a is also the thing that's v squared over r for a circle. And so you see that the r's cancel. And so then that naturally told you that v squared is going to tend to v squared infinity. And v squared infinity was going to be proportional to the square root of the mass for large r. Large r being where m of r is no longer a function of r. And even better than that, so the significance of this was that v to the fourth was then proportional to the mass. And we know that observationally, the Tully-Fisher relation is the observational statement that v to the fourth is proportional to the luminosity. And it was plausible that the mass and the luminosity should be proportional to one another if there is no dark matter, that there's if it's all ordinary matter. So that was the good thing. And then the a naught is about 10 to the minus 10 centimeters per second squared. And the numerology that people remark on is that's in the ballpark of C times h, the present-day Hubble scale. And so then you can make connections, try and make connections based on that. But what's odd about this formulation, formulating like this, is that a whole bunch of things that you take for granted in Newtonian physics are not working anymore. You know, if this is the rule for particle 1, and you had the same rule for particle 2, where the m's were switched, then you no longer have the third law, Newton's third law, that says that the forces are between two particles are canceling each other. And so if you don't have that, that means if you have a collection of particles and you add up the forces acting on that collection, the internal forces aren't canceling anymore like they do for ordinary things. You got your hand up? Yeah. Here? Why that one? Yeah. I'm just saying if you're in this regime where mu is x, then this is going to be a over a naught, so we've got a total of a squared here.
Oh.
And I just took the square root.
What is the relation? What is the function and r in this regime?
Say that again. I didn't hear you. Sorry.
And r, the mass.
Yeah. So here, I did a switch here that here you could think of this as being point particles, but if we had a particle, the previous class when we're talking about particles, like a star in the galaxy, we were imagining it moving in the presence of a distribution of mass. And when I did that, I was saying that what would have been here would have been the m of r would have been the integral up to r, dx of x squared 4 pi times the density. Because normally in Newtonian physics, it's all the mass interior to you if it's a spherical distribution that you're gravitating that's pulling you, and the stuff outside doesn't matter. And so this would have been an r-dependent function. And so for the application to galaxies, then this is something which is depending on r. But once you're out past all the matter, then rho goes to 0, and so then m stops depending on r. So then it's a constant.
But we also have dark matter outside the galaxy.
No, see, the point of this is that you don't have dark matter. So the logic of these modified gravity things is that cosmology is saying, and various evidence is saying, that there's a bunch of stuff you're not seeing. And in principle, there's two things you're not seeing, the dark energy and the dark matter. But the only reason you believe it's there is that the logic of believing it's there is that if we understand gravity properly, we can infer the existence of something that's gravitating. But maybe we don't understand gravity properly. So the idea is that if you do this, you don't need the dark matter. So instead of there being dark matter, you're saying that the laws of gravity are a little bit different at small accelerations. And then that gets rid of the evidence that tells you you needed dark matter. And so then you can do this without the dark matter.
So
dark energy. So one of the things you'd like to do is, supposing this worked, and it does work for galaxies, but supposing it worked for, you know, clusters of galaxies and cosmology, then you could ask the same question: does it also explain dark energy? And there are other modifications of gravity, not this one, that are designed to give you acceleration in the universe, which would be the evidence for dark energy. And none of them do it all, but that's kind of the holy grail, would be if you can find one way of modifying things that gives you all this evidence for the stuff that you think you're not seeing, then that would be more efficient somehow. Yeah?
Is there an action principle or some modified version of, let's say, GR that in a certain limit would give mod?
Thank you. You've set up the next 15 minutes. So yes, there is. and the main message of the next 15 minutes is that that's the right question. So the problem with this is there's a lot of things, if you just apply this particle by particle, there's a lot of things that don't seem to make sense. One of the things would be that you can never escape from something. This is essentially saying that when forces are weak, you have more acceleration than you're bargaining for, right? Because the square root of something small is bigger than the thing itself. And so if you try to have something escape from something, it never escapes because the force is actually bigger than it would have been internally. Yeah.
If you're in the domain of very small accelerations, so that modification actually kicks in, then is that still in accordance with the equivalence principle? Because
no.
It doesn't look like it, right? So
right.
You wouldn't expect to have actually be able to write it down in any geometric fashion, I mean, because that's at the heart of Einstein's theory.
Yeah. You can't write it down with just the metric. Which is kind of where the
okay.
So you need other fields. So what'll happen in the relativistic version is that there'll be the metric and other fields, and that's how they get around that problem. But you guys are hitting all the lists of things. I'm reading from a paper called La Fin du Monde, and it's the list of things that are wrong with Monde. And so one of them is it violates the equivalence principle. Another one is it violates conservation of momentum, which is this third law not working. It says that you can't just add up the forces for subs. You take an object like a galaxy and you divide it into chunks and ask, you know, the great thing about Newton's laws is that if you're interested in how something like a paper moves when you throw it, you can think of the force acting on the paper at the center of mass, or you can think of all the different pieces of the paper interacting amongst one another from their center masses, or you can think of it atom by atom, and it's always the same answer, because the third law that says that the forces between things are canceling is always making sure that all that's relevant to an object is the forces being applied from the outside, and that would all now go. So there's a lot of things that are wrong with this way of thinking about it, and that's kind of why you know not to stop here, that you really want to have that the utility of a Lagrangian formulation or an effective theory is that once you state it, you can apply it to everything and ask, you know, what does it imply for not only the things that you want it to change, but also the things you don't want it to change. And so the questions you're asking are the right ones. You'd like to have an action formulation of this thing that you can now see, does it make sense in other contexts? So is there an action formulation? So the starting point is non-relativistically, there's one. One of the advantages of an action formulation is that things like the failure of momentum to be conserved, which is a consequence of this third law not working, that will be fixed. Because if you have an action formulation, then the usual arguments that say, if I have a symmetry, I have a conservation law, will go through. And so... So what we want is an action formulation. So that's the first thing. And then we also want a relativistic one of the same. And the virtues are that an action formulation allows simple inferences of symmetry consequences, like conservation laws. And it also allows you a more systematic way of trying to decide how your change couples to matter. So if you wanted to say, how do I couple to the standard model? What are the rules? And here this is like all matter. You're being forced to be explicit about the things that you would be testing if you were to look at the implications of this in other such circumstances. So the steps towards this, so let's call this, you know, one and two. So one, the original proposal, so the, you know, there exists at least one, I think there's probably more than one. So non-relativistic action formulation, which has a name, and it's called AQUAL, which I gather stands for a quadratic Lagrangian. And so so the idea here is what they want to do is they want to, so let me write it down. So what we'll do is we'll take the Lagrangian density to be the energy density times the gravitational field. So this is Newtonian here, gravitational potential. And this is the energy density. And then the funny business thing, you know, what the logic of this is that you're trying to modify the kinematic side of the equation, not the force side. And so the thing that's going to be complicated will be not the coupling to matter. So then what they propose is a constant, basically, which is going to be associated with Newton's constant. I guess I might as well write it for you. 8 pi g inverse a naught squared times some function of grad phi dot grad phi divided by a naught squared. So that's their proposed Lagrangian. And so what you do is now you vary the, to get the Newtonian field equation, which will be that one, so you vary phi, and you get that the divergence of a function mu times grad phi is equal to 4 pi g rho, and where mu is df. If you thought of this function here, f, as an arbitrary function, think of f as being a function of x squared, where x is the absolute value of, so x squared is basically the del squared grad phi dot grad phi over a naught squared. Then mu would be df dx. And then the way you read the, once you solve this equation, the idea is that you're going to replace the acceleration with minus grad phi. And that's the rule for how particles are responding to a gravitational field. This is the force law.
What is A0?
A0 is this acceleration scale.
The new scale.
It's the same scale. It's the one that you had to put into the problem. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so then the idea is that you wanted to design mu to be something. This is the mu that you want to. So the statement is that this, for spherically symmetric problems, is equivalent to that, and this mu is that mu. For non-spherically symmetric problems, it's not quite the same. And so that's an interesting thing. One of the advantages of this is that this is more precise. It tells you how to generalize that to different kinds of geometries. But the differences for non-spherical case apparently are not sufficiently big to be a problem for the evidence for dark matter. So then the idea is that you choose this function f so that mu has this property that as a function of x, it starts off linear and then it does something which you don't really care much about and it ends up constant. So I'm going to x and going like x to the 0. And so that would be a framework in which you've got an action formulation which is more useful than this is, but it captures the successes of this in the cases where you like it, in the case of the spherical distribution. I've got a whole bunch of options here I never had before. Do you know how this works?
Oh, yes. There's a button that gives
you... Do I want to scroll here?
So these ones will do it. If you go to the manual, then you can do it individually.
I see. Okay, thank you. All right. Yeah.
Do you fix the form for f after deriving the equation?
No. So you're supposed to think that God gives you this function, and then once you have the function, you just go through and turn the crank. And
so you need to know what f is before you write down that equation, right?
Exactly. So specifying the theory is to saying this is true, and I give you a number for a, and I give you a function for f. And then to capture the success there, your function has to be such that when I calculate mu, it has that kind of property. And so one of the questions will be, you know, how much freedom do you have in a Lagrangian choosing functions like that? Can you make up random functions here? And is that something which is reasonable in nature? But all those questions become much more crisp in this Lagrangian way of thinking about it. So it's a step forward to have a Lagrangian way to think about things. Right, now there is a relativistic proposal. You know, drawbacks of this would be, if you think about the evidence for dark matter, this would allow you to talk about clusters of galaxies, because now you have a way of phrasing things, and you can hope that somehow the naive thing is not going to work. The naive thing would have been that the accelerations involved for clusters of galaxies are larger than A0, because the place where dark matter is playing an important role is at a different acceleration range than it was true for galaxies themselves. And so at face value, and in the original Mond paper, Milgram says this, that acknowledges this, that for clusters of galaxies, something else is going on. But then with a more precise framework, you can kind of try and re-ask that question more carefully to see if you can really salvage the story for clusters of galaxies. But you know that no matter what you do there, once you go to cosmology, like the evidence from lensing in galaxies and things like that, you're going to need some relativistic framework, because you're going to need to know how relativistic things interact with this gravitational field. And things like tests of the equivalence principle you're going to want to know about. And so what you really need is this part two, the relativistic formulation. And this is the best one on the market is this TeVS, which is for tensor vector scalar theory. And so it proposes that you have the metric, as you usually do. You have matter, as you usually do, say the standard model. But then you also have a vector field and a scalar field. And that's the V and the S. And then there's kind of a convoluted construction, which is not on these things. And I'm not intending to kind of go through in detail what the construction is or its merits. But people have kind of looked at it for a while. And I think it's probably true. It's an open question whether or not this is a better description of the world than dark matter. But the weaknesses, I think, now are that it's hard to get things like the microwave background right, because there's a lot of things in the microwave background that you have to get right. It's not completely clear. There's stability issues that people worry about. If you have a spherically symmetric distribution and you kind of set this thing up, do the fluctuations in these fields, are they stable or are they runaways? If they're runaways, it's a problem, because then that really means that the existence of the vacuum is your real problem, not your cosmology. But I think it's one of those things where I would say it's the fair thing to say is that the end of the road hasn't come yet. So I think the final word on whether those are really problems or not problems is probably not out yet. So let me just kind of sketch the action, and then I won't tell you much about what to do with it. So the Lagrangian there'll be a gravity one. So the metric one, there'll be a vector one. There'll be a scalar one, and then there'll be a matter one. So the gravity one is the Einstein-Hilbert one, so it's 1 over 16 pi g. I'm going to put a minus sign there because I use different conventions from what these guys do. Times r twiddle. And then the twiddles are, where are we here? Twiddle metric is related to the other metrics in a way that, let me just put it here. So, g mu nu is related to the g twiddle mu nu by things involving the scalar and the vector. This is All right. And the idea is that the matter Lagrangian is a function of the matter field. Let me call them collectively psi, and then this metric, g mu nu, which is not the metric that's in the Einstein action. They're related by a conformal factor, but also by this what they call a disformal factor, where you've got the vector field. Then the vector action is a Maxwellian one with constants in it, if I remember right. So there's a conventional minus 1 over 32 pi g. There's a root minus g twiddle. And there's a constant, I'll call it k, times f mu nu. And f mu nu is the usual thing. It's the curl of the vector. But then there's another piece, which is it's a thing that's going to impose a constraint that says that this vector is time-like. So it's v mu plus 1. I thought that was like a sharp intake of breath. That it's and then the scalar piece is also complicated. It's where are we here? So it's minus 1 over 16 pi g. There's kind of various ways to formulate it. Let me give you not this one. Let me give you another one. Well, let me give you this one. It's probably as good as any. So we've got minus g twiddle. Then mu t twiddle mu nu grad twiddle mu phi grad twiddle nu phi plus v of mu. And mu is a field. It's like what they call a non-dynamical field. It's a field that you're supposed to vary, but there's no kinetic term for it. And then
complex scalar or real?
Real scalar. And this function v is the thing that is you're going to whose choice is going to filter into become this function f, and so it'll become that function mu. So you just choose v of mu to get the answer that you want for up here. Something with its properties here. So you can kind of see that what you asked about the equivalence principle applies, that there's a because of there's essentially a preferred frame in your problem, because V is being asked to take a value which is like the rest frame of the cosmological fluid. It's something which is telling you there's a preferred rest frame in the universe set by the frame in which this V is, you know, in the time direction only and not in the space direction, which may or may not align with the cosmological fluid. But in cosmology, I think they typically take it to be aligned. There's a scalar field that's varying, and a lot of things going on there. And you can kind of see why it takes a while to make sure that this theory is making sense, because there's a lot of things that you have to check the stability of. It's, you know, one of the, you know, so this is not a, red flags normally go up when people start running complicated functions of derivatives, because there's a higher derivative theories are notoriously unstable. And that's because there's a general argument by, I think it's Oskar Gradsky or something from the 19th century. It's not very often you get to cite a paper from the 19th century, but this is one of those times. But it's there's an argument that says if you have a Lagrangian system which involves, let me actually make this argument more carefully. So there's a general worry about theories, Lagrangians, involving higher time derivatives. And this is due to, I think, Ostrogradsky. I think. And the cartoon of the argument is that if you normally what you do when you have a Lagrangian, you have a whole bunch of dynamical degrees of freedom, you think of the Lagrangian being a function of those things and their first time derivatives. And then you go through and you define, when you're doing a Hamiltonian analysis, you define the momenta to be, you know, the derivative of L with respect to Q dot. And then you define the Hamiltonian to be, you know, P Q dot minus L. And you write that as a function of the Q's and the P's. And then a good sign that things are stable or have a chance of being stable is if H is bounded from below. Because then if you're at the minimum energy, you know there's nowhere you can go. And so that'll be a stable place. So the observation that he made was that supposing someone gives you a Lagrangian that is not like this, it has actually, it's a function of higher derivatives of Q. So if L is a function of Q, Q dot dot, and you can imagine kind of going down the road here. You can still do this Hamiltonian description. You define, you know, P. So what will happen is your equations of motion will now be higher order in time. So instead of getting second order equations, you're going to get, you know, third and fourth and higher order equations in time. And so that means that your initial data, when you're integrating those equations, you'll need more of them. And so in this language here, then the utility of the Hamiltonian, you know, the logic of the Hamiltonian construction is by setting up, by trading Q dot for P, what you've done is you've traded the second order Lagrangian equations into a set of first order equations where rate of change of P and rate of change of Q are equal to some functions of P and Q. So it's the kind of thing that you can put on a computer and just integrate it because it's a first order set of equations where you just specify the initial values of the P's and Q's and then you're good and you can integrate into the future. So the number of P's you have is related to the number of initial conditions you needed to specify. And the fact that you have one P for every Q is kind of coming from the fact that you were allowed in the second order equation to specify the Q's and their first derivatives. But if you have more than just Q and Q dot in your Lagrangian, then your equations will be higher order. And that means that initially you'll have to specify the positions, the velocities, and maybe the accelerations, and everything up to the just below the highest number of derivatives you had. So you can still do this kind of a construction of the Hamiltonian evolution. You can define more momenta. So you can define P to be dl dq dot, and you can define a new one, you know, si could be dl dq dot dot I, and so on. So you can do this kind of for as many of these as you want. And you can do a construction like the Hamiltonian construction where you now have a set of first order things where your equations of motion will be Q dot is equal to function of Q, P, and S, and P dot will be a function of Q, P, and S, and S dot will be a function of Q, P, and S, and as many of these things as you need. And you'll have one of these for every extra derivative you had. And the important thing that he shows is that if you go through the construction and you calculate what H is, so the point is that H is linear in at least one of these new ones. And so if it's linear, it can't be bounded from below. So that means that if you kind of plot the H as a function of your initial conditions, there's always something for which H can get as negative as you like. And so the generic danger is that if you take some generic set of initial conditions, that's where you're going to go. You're going to roll down the configurations with lower energy, and there's nothing to stop you. You just keep on going. And that's a reflection of that is if you write down higher order equations of motion involving more than just two derivatives, they generically have runaway solutions, that they have, in addition to the solutions that you like, there's very often a solution which is exponentially growing in time. And they're kind of related statements. So so what I'm not saying is that Tevis has this problem, but what I am saying is that if somebody hands you a Lagrangian like that, all the flags should go off in your mind because there's a very general argument saying that higher time derivatives are generically worrisome. There are exceptions where this is not a problem. If you have a conformally invariant theory, it can happen that these dangerous directions might be pure gauge directions. So there's ways in which you can kind of avoid these things, but they're not kind of generic ways. So the You do the same kind of a construction. I can't remember what it is. I didn't actually prepare it.
It's a generalization of the formula.
It's the same kind of a thing where you'd have a linear combination of P and Q dot and the new one and Q dot dot and so on. And it's being designed in such a way that you can set up the equations of motion in this Hamiltonian form where it's first derivative of the thing is equal to functions of the things themselves. And so the chain of logic is that you're not so worried by something like this where you've got complicated space derivatives. But once you make it relativistic and you start tying the space derivatives to the time derivatives, so if you have a function of, you know, what's going to happen here is that mu, when you solve the mu equation, if this is an interesting function, mu will become a function of grad phi squared. And then that function of grad phi squared that you're looking for, that's why it's going to come from v, because the equation of motion for mu will relate mu to grad phi, and then grad phi squared. And so then now when you see mu anywhere, you're going to plug in grad phi squared, including the metric dependence and everything. But because it's relativistic, the space derivatives are coming with time derivatives, and so you're getting, potentially you're getting complicated functions of time derivatives. And they're only first derivatives, but you're getting many of them. And so there will be a question. There'll be a question, as you'll see down the road next week, if you're organizing how you think about Lagrangians, the way that you normally control derivatives is you're thinking in terms of, if you're looking at low energies, then you're looking at slow things, then you're doing a derivative expansion when you're writing down what the action is, and that's why you typically are always writing down things involving the fewest number of derivatives. But once you start writing down many, many, or complicated functions of first derivatives, you have to then start asking, well, why aren't the second derivatives also important? And then why don't we have to start worrying about these things? And so it's not a simple question, and I'm not saying it is a problem for these theories, but it's that's why people focus so much on stability, because you've opened a door where there's a very plausible way instabilities could have come in, and so you really have to check that they didn't come in. And so the fact that it's still talked about is a good sign. It means that a lot of the obvious places they could have come in, it didn't come in, but that's why people worry about it so much. So that's kind of, I think, the best case modification of gravity that's been proposed so far. And the criticisms of modifying gravity, I think everybody likes the premise. It would be much more efficient and much simpler to have one modification of gravity rather than having several kinds of matter that you haven't seen before. That, I think, everyone buys. But then once you've done it, you have to then ask, have you successfully accounted for all the evidence for the matter? Did you really do what you hoped to do? And there's another suite of issues that I haven't talked about, which I will talk about in the next few weeks, and that is the consistency of, once you quantize things and you have a quantum theory that involves gravity, a question that you should always be doing when you do an analysis that's classical is you have to ask what's controlling the classical approximation? Why is it a good approximation to solve for the classical behavior of something rather than treating it like a quantum system? And there's a good answer to that, although you might, in the 60s, people talked about how quantum mechanics, one half of your brain knew about quantum mechanics, the other half knew about gravity, but they didn't know about each other. And that's not the way to think about quantum gravity. Quantum gravity has lots of interesting things at high energies, but at low energies, it's very well understood how quantum mechanics plays a role with gravity. And so in that story of why low energy quantum gravity makes sense, you have to then, in all these situations, ask, quantum mechanics and gravity make sense, but in a very delicate way. And so you have to make sure that you don't screw up the delicacy of gravity playing, or quantum mechanics playing nice with relativity. And so all those issues, people worry about, and you should worry about, and if you do this stuff, you will worry about. But that's all I was going to say, unless there's anything you want to ask. Yeah.
Is Mond alone the Newtonian limit of Tillis?
I don't think it's so much low energy, but I think it would be the non-relativistic kind of quasi-static, spherically symmetric point particle case. So which is the right limit to be in if you're thinking about particles in a galaxy. So it's not a crazy limit, but it's not just the low energy limit.
It's not obvious from this expression that is the limit.
No. So, the logic of what you would do is you'd kind of derive this first. So I think this is supposed to get to this, and then the fact that this is giving you that is an easier thing to verify. And then the way that you see this is happening, you're looking for some sort of Lagrangian involving functions of grad phi squared. And the way you'll see that is that if you integrate out mu, so you vary mu and then replace it by its equation of motion, then if this is something like mu squared or something, and you can see that mu will be equal to this, you want a more complicated function than mu squared. And then you want to see that that's going to introduce functions of grad phi squared into your action, and then you want to see that in the non-relativistic limit it becomes that. You had a question.
Yeah.
There.
So how many propagating degrees of freedom does this theory have? Like, so phi is like some scalar as well. How many degrees are sitting in the vector?
That's a good question. The options are two or three, right? And I'm not completely sure off the top of my head. I think I want to say it's three, because
it's strange to be timed like that. So
yeah, because if it had been true that you had the gauge invariant, if it had been true that you didn't write this term, then you would have had the argument that you would normally make for electromagnetism, that there's only 2 degrees of freedom, because you have the gauge condition and then the constraint that goes with it. But once you start doing things like this, then I think you're really thinking, it should be thinking of it as being something carrying three spin states.
But the mod itself only has one new variable, right, which is A0.
And it's not even, that at face value, not even a propagating variable, because that's right. The Newtonian potential.
So it's not really obvious how this ever becomes that, right?
No, I'm not saying it's obvious, no,
sure.
It's true. But I'm reading this from a review by Tony Padilla and a bunch of other people, and so there are lots of reviews on this. If you really want to track this down, those limits have been taken carefully. So that part of it is not there's no doubt that you can get the MOND from this theory. That part of it people are fairly sure of. But the open issues are more these issues of consistency of the theory, whether or not it's stable or not.
So similar to what Ian was asking, does it have like the gravitational wave solutions?
And more than just the, so that besides the metric propagating, you also have these other fields will propagate too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the phi here, it's important that the phi here is not necessarily gravitational phi. So that so the way you'll make contact with that is that you'll take the metric and you'll start thinking of it in terms of its scalar. Normally G00 would have been the capital phi. And so there'll be a mixing going on between G00 and little phi. And so the derivatives of, one of the things that's not so obvious here is why does this phi appear in anything to do with the gravitational field? And what's happening is that the capital phi that's in the metric is mixing with the scalar field like it always does. And we're going to say more about that in the next few weeks. And so then having a function of phi can turn into functions of capital phi because of that mixing. We good? Okay, so if you're good, then what I wanted to do was to contrast this with the dark matter. So there's a whole infinite number of dark matter models, and the assignment will be partly to do with going through one, just the simplest one, my favorite one. So it's and again, in the same way, I don't want to argue that these are wrong. I don't want to argue that dark matter models with particles are right. But you'll see that you're fighting fewer things with the dark matter models. If you kind of ask the same questions that we've been asking here, what are the things that the dark matter models get right and what are the ones they don't get right, you'll see that essentially all the evidence that I gave you for cosmology and structure formation and clusters of galaxies and lensing and galaxies themselves, dark matter, particle dark matter will get right. The biggest question mark is the final one, the details of dark matter in galaxies. And in that case, it's not clear that they get it wrong or right, because in order to see the distribution of matter within a galaxy in the center of the galaxy, one of the puzzles is, in the center of the galaxy, simulations tend to give you more dark matter than is seen. You don't typically see any evidence for dark matter at all in the centers of the galaxies, but the simulations would say there should be a lot of it there. But the cases where there's a problem tend to be cases where the simulations, they don't normally include the effects of the baryons, because those are more complicated because they interact electromagnetically. And so the thing that is open there is whether or not you've included all the effects that are the size of what you're trying to track, given that you've neglected the baryons. And so the question mark in that class of models is do they get galaxies and the distributions of sizes of galaxies right? And the open question is the ordinary baryonic physics being done properly at an accuracy yet that you could tell for sure? At face value, they seem to be getting some things wrong, but the errors in the predictions are not clear yet. But you'll see that a lot of these other issues are not really a big deal, because all you really rely for the success of the other lines of evidence is that you have something which is behaving gravitationally like a non-relativistic particle, and that's the easy part in this other way of thinking about it. Okay. So the question, so the next topic is particle dark matter. And I'm not going to take you through, in the same spirit as we did here, I'm not going to take you through the great details of a bunch of models, but you can do more details because they're less complicated, and that'll be what the assignment is partly about. So the idea is, there are a lot of particles there already. Let's have a few more. So can you explain the dark matter phenomena, all of the phenomena, using plausible new particles?
Question. So when you talk about structure formation, does that also include the filament and void structure?
In principle, it should be all of it, yeah. Because as time goes on, there's more and more information about how things form, yeah. All I really talked about explicitly was just the gross power spectrum, but really it gets more and more detailed as time goes on. And then you get more and more of these issues as to what extent were the baryons important in the details of what you're seeing. Because in practice, when you're comparing to observations, you're not actually seeing the dark matter, you're seeing the baryons. And the spirit, there's this thing called bias, right? Which I don't know if you've got. So, when you do dark matter simulations, you find that the dark, and you look at galaxies, they kind of form these filaments across the sky. And the understanding of that is you might say, well, why should I find, if I have a galaxy here, why should I find more likelihood to have galaxies nearby? The way to think about that is that, or at least the party line as to how to think about that, is that you've got dark matter, and then the baryons fell into the dark matter, and if there's enough of them, then you've got enough density of baryons, then they started forming stars, and then you see them. But the thinking there is that if you had a dark matter distribution, which is kind of up and down, there's going to be some, only the highest ones are going to be deep enough that, so I'm plotting here, say, density of dark matter against position. There will be places where there's more dark matter than there is other places, and things will fall towards that, including the baryons. But unless you get enough baryons, you won't get enough hot, and you won't get enough gas, and the gas won't form stars. And so it's only going to be the very deepest or the various biggest overdensities that you'll start to see things, because that's where the galaxies will form. So the belief is that if I kind of emphasize that there's kind of a variety of sizes you could have had, the belief is that there might be a statement like you'll only get galaxies once you get past a certain point. So here you have an overdensity of dark matter, but you won't see it because there's no galaxies in it, whereas here you will because there's enough stuff falling in that you actually get enough gas to get stars and get galaxies. And so in that kind of, and so this is called the bias. This would be, there's some number which will be telling you that there's a threshold above which you have to be in order to get enough stuff to make galaxies, and that's an unknown number. So people have to kind of, one of the uncertainties in what people do when they compare observations to the predictions is they have to tell you what the bias is. But if there is bias, then this kind of pattern is pretty natural, because if you imagine taking the world and filling it with water, which we're in the presence of, the process of doing now, I guess, and you ask, and you're standing on Mount Everest, and as the water comes up and starts to lap at your feet, or let's say that the other way around. Let's say that you're Noah, and so the world was full of water, and you're standing on Mount Everest, and the water's up to your knees, and then the water goes down, and you ask, where does the land first start to appear? Well, it first starts to appear at your feet because you're at the highest place, but then the next time it appears, it'll be near you because the next highest thing in a mountain range is normally not far from the highest thing because they're all, you had some sort of a big, Tibet was here, and then on top of that, you had all these fluctuations that gave you the mountains. But all the big ones are in the same place because they're on top of a larger fluctuation. And so if you have a mountain range, you expect to find that as the water went down, you're going to get chains of islands like the Hawaiian Islands or something because the fluctuations are correlated. If you get a big one, there's likely to be one near you because they're all on some big overdensity. And so that's the picture that people have as to these filaments. But then getting it right and really knowing that you've got no errors, a lot of that is saying, well, what was the threshold? And there's a lot of uncertainties in that. So the more detailed you get, the more you have to fight these uncertainties. So because they're going to come for you soon, let me just kind of see if I can finish the thought. So So the goal will be we're going to make up some particles, and the message of this section is that it's actually fairly easy to do this. And the constraints that you have are, if you just make up some particles in something like the standard model, what you have to arrange to happen is that the density of whatever those particles are, they have to be around us with the abundance that the dark matter has for some reason. And so if you have a cosmology, if you know what the particles are doing, you can predict what the abundances of everything are. And that's the evidence we have for the hot Big Bang come down to the evidence for relics, that if you have, when you form nuclei, you see the distribution of nuclei that are left, they no longer get destroyed because the universe is getting colder. So that abundance is something you can measure. Or when the atoms form, the transition in the opacity of the universe is observable. And when at some point electrons and positrons annihilate, as you'll see, and when they do that, they heat up the plasma they're in relative to the neutrinos, which are no longer talking to them, and that has observable consequences in principle if you could see the neutrinos. And so the whole evidence we have already for the Big Bang is coming from the ability to predict relics. And normally they're being predicted under the assumption that they were all in thermal equilibrium in the past, and then as time went on, they were no longer in equilibrium, and they stopped, because of that, they stopped, they didn't disappear. If things now were only the things you get from equilibrium, then it wouldn't be very informative, because equilibrium is very generic and doesn't really tell you much about the history of the universe. It's the things that have gone out of equilibrium but then survive, and our relics are the things that we can successfully calculate. And so the goal for dark matter is you will have some story as to what this particle is. So that'll involve telling you how it interacts with ordinary matter and with gravity. And then you'll say, in the early universe, you'll have to say what you thought the initial conditions were. And the most attractive models are the ones that say the initial conditions were everything was in equilibrium, because that's a very generic initial condition, and you don't have to kind of fine-tune some choice about the initial conditions to get what you want at later times. So if your assumption is that your initial conditions were thermal, that's called thermal dark matter. So then the idea would be that you know the interactions, and you can calculate the relic abundance of these things in the same way that you calculate the relic abundance of nuclei and other things in the standard model. And so, so the main message, the summary message of the next lectures, is that those things are actually fairly easy to arrange. That you need three things essentially for a particle to pass the test of surviving in the right abundance now to account for the dark matter that we see. If you thought it was a new kind of a particle. So let me just write those things, and then we can justify them next time. So the challenge is you have to design the particle properties to get the correct relic abundance. So you have to, that means you have to choose an initial state. And a choice, but a very attractive choice, is a attractive choice is just to assume that everybody's, including this new particle, are in equilibrium. Particle is in equilibrium. With ordinary matter. If you go far enough back in time, I guess that's the thing, early enough, and so that would be what you would call thermal dark matter. And so the argument I want to make for you is that this needs three things. Or sufficient condition for this so the sufficient conditions for the new particle to give you a good relic abundance, assuming it was initially in equilibrium. The first one is it's got to be long-lived. It can't decay before now. Second thing is if it has a mass kind of in the ballpark of 100 GeV. And a third condition would be interactions similar to the weak interactions. In strength. Those three things give you what you want. And the reason this is fairly easy to do is that in almost any modification that people think about in particle physics to the standard model, the new particles, whatever they are heavy enough that they haven't been seen yet. And that normally means they're kind of here or a little bit heavier. If they're lighter than that, they have to be weakly coupled, more weakly coupled, so you wouldn't have seen them yet. But this is kind of a generic place for them to be. 100 might be 500. It's kind of in that ballpark. That's why people look in the LHC for particles in that range. It's generic to have them there. It's also very generic to have this, because these interactions are like dirt. If you don't have electromagnetic interactions which are stronger than this, or strong interactions which are stronger than this, then what's left is typically the weak interactions. If you exchange particles whose masses are like this, you get interactions like this. And so it's kind of a very generic kind of an interaction. Just a sec. So the thing that's not automatic is this. If you take the standard model itself, it's full of particles that are like this and like this. The Z boson is an example. The only thing that's wrong with it, and the reason we don't think it's dark matter, is that it decays in 10 to the minus 23 seconds. So the only thing you have to arrange, really, these two are going to be for free, essentially. And this is the thing that you have to arrange, and that's not hard to arrange. If you have a new conserved thing that you assign this particle and it's the lightest thing with that charge, it can't decay because it can't lose that charge. So that's what people normally are doing when they make a dark matter model, and they're taking advantage of what's called the WIMP miracle. And the WIMP miracle is just the observation that these two things kind of automatically give you something you like. You had a question.
What stops you from having, say, some species of dark matter which decays into another species of dark matter?
Nothing stops you. That
nothing stops you, right?
Yeah. You can make many, many more complicated models than this, and people do a lot of those models. The spirit people normally have is that you can do that, and people didn't do it, you know, right from the very beginning because it's kind of complicated for its own sake. But if you have specific things you're trying to explain, like gamma rays coming from the center of the galaxy or something, then you can kind of start engineering that kind of thing by a scenario like that. But it's the basic, as long as the original thing that was decaying had the right abundance, which is this thing could do for you, then that would typically be an example of a non-thermal story where you have maybe it's something that was thermal, and then it decays to something else, and that's the thing you see now as dark matter. And there's a really rich literature on that kind of a thing. So the goal next time will be to justify the WIMP miracle. So the statement will be that cross-sections in the weak interactions scale, masses in the 100 GeV scale, if the particle was stable, are going to give you the right abundance just if it came out of equilibrium. And then that'll be the first observation, and then you'll want to know, so how this is sufficient, how much space do you have to play around with things? And you can make the masses lighter, if you make the interactions weaker, there's lots of things you can do. But identifying how this works shows you what the answer depends on. That's where we're going to go. So now they're going to come and collect you and show you to the TV cameras.